kiss on the hand, maybe? Quite continental, but diamonds are a girl's best friend. A kiss may be grand, but it won't pay the rent on your humble flat or help you at the automat. Men grow cold as girls grow old, and we all lose our charms in the end. But square cut or pear shaped, these rocks don't lose their shape. Diamonds are a girl's best friend.
That Dominic Sandbrook was, of course, Marilyn Monroe, perhaps the most iconic.
Tom, nobody's still listening. There's no point talking. Nobody's still listening.
I thought that was a magnificent performance. The most iconic of all Hollywood stars. I realized when I was reading up about her that she is, of course, the same age as the Queen. So if she was still alive now, she'd be 96.
Born in 1926. Yeah.
But of course, you know, in Diamonds Are a Girl's Best Friend, she famously says men grow cold as girls grow old. But Marilyn never grew old. She died when she was 36. And so she...
That's right, yeah.
She serves as a kind of, you know, undying icon of femininity. But this is not a, you know, this is the rest is history. This is not the rest is Hollywood. So what is the justification, do you think, for doing an episode on Marilyn Monroe in a history podcast?
Well, Marilyn Monroe, still very unusually for a film star whose career ended in 1962, has an enormous amount of pop cultural traction even now, doesn't she? I mean, basically the peg for us doing this is the Ana de Armas film, the Netflix film Blonde, based on Joyce Carol Oates' novel, which is out, I think, has just come out this last week on Netflix and in some cinemas. But also, I suppose, Marilyn Monroe, she's a classic example of that sort of 20th century figure who becomes an avatar for all kinds of other things. So I think she's an avatar for the classical age of Hollywood, for a kind of innocent, well, we'll go on to talk about whether it is innocent, for a sense of hedonism and a sort of pre-sexual revolution kind of pleasure-seeking. But also, of course, I think she's a symbol of 50s America, of Eisenhower's, you know, specifically, I would say Eisenhower's America, the Cold War, buoyant, optimistic, intensely consumerist, the world after the Second World War. I think Marilyn Monroe, the very image of her sort of kindles in people's minds this sort of sense of, and of course this is, we can unpick all this, this sort of lost paradise of American dominance and of Americanization. And I think that's what she represents as much as anything, don't you?
Well, except to the degree that she's also a tragic figure. So she's also, she's an embodiment of the dark side of the American dream. She's been caught up in the snarl of, you know, the, what is it, the paranoid style of politics. What was the...
Yes, Richard Hofstadter, the paranoid style in American politics. So the way in which she's become the subject to so many conspiracy theories.
Absolutely. So she dies a year before JFK gets assassinated. And of course, she was involved with JFK, although to what degree is furiously debated. So she has been caught up in the snarl of all those conspiracy theories. But also, in a way, she's a kind of icon of a pre-feminist age, but it's very, very easy to interpret her as a feminist figure, I think, both because she clearly suffered at the hands of a male-dominated Hollywood establishment, but also, I think, because she played quite an important role in pushing back against that. And I would say also the other reason why she's fascinating is that she's like a kind of magnet that picks up all the iron filings of the broader culture of America in that period. So she touches on advertising. She sings to troops in the Korean War. She engages with sport in the form of Joe DiMaggio, the great baseball star who she marries, with intellectual life in the form of Arthur Miller, who she then goes on to marry. Arthur Miller is embroiled in the McCarthy investigations, and Marilyn plays a quite heroic role in that, I think. She's a friend of Frank Sinatra, so there's a hint of the mafia there as well. I mean, she's, I think, a really kind of totemic figure historically. So I hope that we have justified doing this podcast on her.
Well, she has an also a dimension that you hinted at a second ago, which we can perhaps go into later, which is you talked about her suffering. So the Joyce Carol Oates book, Blonde, for example, on which the current film, the Ana de Armas film, is based, is one of a host of sort of pop cultural visions of Marilyn Monroe that casts her as a victim. And actually, whether she was a victim is worth discussing. Of course, we live now in a kind of cultural landscape in which victimhood is highly prized. And indeed celebrated. But whether Marilyn Monroe was she a victim, or was she an immensely canny operator who rose from nowhere to get to the top and did so not by suffering, but by being professional, hardworking, remaking herself, all those kinds of things. I mean, that's something else that is worth debating.
I think it's possible for her to have been both. I mean, I think she did have quite a traumatic life. Her upbringing was pretty rough.
But more traumatic than, say, Audrey Hepburn?
Well, I think there's a kind of Dickensian quality to the role that she mythologized her upbringing. But I think it clearly did leave scars. I think she probably, I don't want to go all psychoanalytical, although Marilyn's engagement with psychoanalysis is another very, very kind of paradigmatic 1950s American thing. But I think she did have, to a degree, daddy issues, perhaps. But I know that both of us hugely admire one book in particular on Marilyn, which was very much friend of the show, Sarah Churchwell, who did a fantastic episode with us on Gone with the Wind. And she wrote, I think it's her first book, isn't it? The Many Lives of Marilyn Monroe.
Yeah.
In which she, it's a book not just less about Marilyn than about how Marilyn has been understood and presented. And right in the opening page, I'll just read it. So she's talking about the death, which is obviously the most controversial and object of particular fascination. It is hardly news that Marilyn Monroe's death remains controversial. More surprisingly, the mysteries surrounding her death are not the only confusions in her story. Uncertainty is the story of Marilyn's biographical life. We don't know nearly as much about her as people may assume. Although Marilyn Monroe was one of the most famous, most photographed, most written about people in the 20th century, we know less about her for certain than about many far more distant historical figures. So I think that's absolutely true, and Sarah demonstrates it pretty conclusively in her book. But the implications of that for the study of history and biography more generally is really quite destabilizing. So we did an episode on Theodora, the circus performer who ends up marrying Justinian, the Roman emperor. And historians debate, you know, how much of the stories told in the scandalous stories told about, how far are they true? But obviously we cannot know. Because if we can't know key details about Marilyn Monroe's life, then what earthly hope do we have of ever kind of arriving at solid ground when we study the life, say, of an ancient Roman empress?
I think that's absolutely right, Tom. When I was reading Sarah Churchwell's book, I was thinking she reflects quite often about these figures in history who we claim to know. How much do we actually really know, or how much are we simply... She gives brilliant examples in the book of biographers who repeat other biographers who are actually repeating the original, you know, these stories kind of going around in a circle. And merely because the story is told many times, it becomes enshrined as a fact. But as she says, you know, especially with somebody who sex and romance are such an important part of their image. But with those kinds of matters, you can never really know what happens between two people, or, you know, so much of that. You talked about the Kennedy story. I mean, ultimately, the truth of the Kennedy story is nobody knows, or will ever know, or can ever know.
So Norman Mailer, who I suppose is the kind of polar opposite of Joyce Carol Oates. He's the hard drinking misogynist.
Yeah.
But he wrote obsessively about Marilyn. And he said, why not assume that Marilyn Monroe opens the entire problem of biography? And I think actually he's kind of right. Because you think Marilyn is the, you know, one of the most recognizable faces of the 20th century. So Dominic, I mean, if we go right back to the beginning, there's a particular mystery in what we don't, it's very difficult to pin down what her name was. So famously, she wasn't born Marilyn Monroe, Norma Jean, as in Elton John. And that idea that Norma Jean is the real Marilyn and that Marilyn Monroe is a fake is a very kind of powerful idea. It's what animated Candle in the Wind and a lot of studies. But I think it's slightly more complicated than that, isn't it?
I think it is more complicated because, I mean, Sarah Churchwell says in her book, you know, the classic division that biographers make is between Norma Jean, who was authentic and real, and Marilyn Monroe, who was a fake, and this was an example of kind of selling her soul and all this stuff. I mean, actually, of course, changing your name was completely common in 1940s Hollywood, wasn't it? I mean, you think of Cary Grant, you think of any number of stars.
John Wayne.
John Wayne, right, exactly. I mean,
I mean, John Wayne doesn't seem to have been unduly traumatized by it.
No, I mean, it's absolutely, I don't think she sold her soul in changing her name, and nor do I think she lost touch with her original identity or anything like that. She's born Norma Jean Mortensen, isn't she? And Mortensen is not her father. I mean, she's illegitimate. I know you're keen to psychoanalyze her. I mean, obviously, you were saying that there's a sort of search for, hunt for a father. I mean, that's something I think that probably male biographers love to ascribe to her.
Well, she did call all her husbands daddy. I'm just throwing that out.
She did. But again, Tom, who knows?
I know.
Who can honestly say why that is, or whether that represents some deep-seated lack, or is it just a quirk? I mean, we just don't know these kinds of things. It's easy. It's tempting for us to speculate, but I think to some degree, this is a classic example of why it's sometimes actually more fruitful to resist speculation than to admit what you don't know.
But what I would also say is that she presented herself in the early years of her fame as an orphan. She wasn't an orphan.
Yeah.
But she might as well have been. So her mother ends up being committed. She's very mentally distressed. But her mother is called Monroe. That's her maiden name.
Yes.
She burns through men. So she takes on a lot of different names over the course of her life. And so that, I think, is, you say, Mortensen is one of them. Baker is another. And so it goes on. But actually, in a way, Monroe is the most authentic. You know, it's a much more authentic name than any of the other names that Marilyn was given. So
we did a podcast, Tom, about California many moons ago. And we were talking in the California podcast about this phenomenon of people from the Midwest, poor Midwesterners, moving west to California in search kind of the promised land. I mean, to some extent, you know, people will remember that kind of image from The Grapes of Wrath or something. Well, that's what her mother's story was. Her mother was a poor Midwesterner who's had a wretched life. You know, she was had constant mental health troubles. She's, as you said, she's sort of in and out of homes and asylums. Marilyn's father, I think it's now generally agreed, was somebody called Charles Stanley Gifford.
He was a video editor, wasn't he? Film editor.
Exactly. And a sort of fleeting relationship he had with her mother. They were never, you know, a sort of meaningful couple. And Marilyn never, I think, really knew him. And Marilyn herself was Marilyn. I mean, she's called Norma Jean, of course, at this stage. So she's born in 1926. She grows up in the Depression. The Depression is far worse in the United States than it is in many European countries, much worse than it was in Britain. So she grows up in a climate of kind of austerity and misery and so on. She's in and out of homes with different kind of foster parents. She's in an orphanage at one stage, isn't she?
Yeah, for 21 months. And she, it's kind of stories about having to do all the washing up all the time, which is very like Dickens in the Bathing Factory.
I mean, that's what you say about the Dickens. But of course, what we know about that from her comes from interviews that she gave many, many years later.
Of course.
Or kind of ghost-written things. And again, it's very hard to ever get, I mean, how much do you know about somebody's early life from stories they tell decades later? How much do they really know themselves? I mean, these are all, as Norman Mailer would say, these are the fundamental questions of all biographies, not just biographies of Marilyn Monroe.
Yeah. And one of them, of course, one of the key mysteries is whether she was sexually abused, sexually assaulted, on which, again, there have been many interpretations. And because it's seen as being somehow crucially important to explaining the woman that she becomes, people worry at it obsessively. But I think it's one of these things, you know, Sarah Churchwell points out that we can't know. We just can't know.
No, we can't. And I think what happens with, so the sexual abuse issue is an interesting one because it sort of opens up two different avenues of inquiry. One is the idea that Marilyn Monroe was always a victim. She was always abused by men. And that obviously is the sort of Joyce Carol Oates vision of her. Very, very popular vision today. The other is what you might call the sort of slightly more Norman Mailer-ish vision, which is that she's always all about sex. So Norman Mailer has this extraordinary line where he says of her, she was deliverance, a very Stradivarius of sex, so gorgeous, forgiving, humorous, compliant, and tender that even the most mediocre musician would relax his lack of art in the dissolving magic of her violin. And this sort of idea that she's steeped in sex from the first minute to the last.
Insane sexual musk was another phrase he used about her.
Yeah, I mean, that's very distasteful now to us, but I mean, there's an element of truth in it, and her image was always obviously deeply wrapped up with sex. And was she abused as a child, and how did that therefore feed into that? I mean, again, this is a classic example of, it's all speculation, isn't it? It's all projection from the legions of writers who have kind of voyeuristically picked over the details of her story. And I think the most honest thing to say is that we actually don't have the faintest idea.
But I think also, I mean, it's indisputable that if you are a very, very beautiful girl without much education from a series of broken homes, in Los Angeles, on the margins of Hollywood, there are a lot of very rapacious, predatory men. And yeah. Marilyn became, she Norma Jean, and then she gets given the name Marilyn by studios. That's clearly part of the world that she was in. And one of the animating things that drives her throughout her career is a deep sense of hostility to the kind of the power brokers and the heads of the studios, who clearly, I think, I don't think there's any dispute about this, had been very, very abusive to her early in her career. And that is one of the kind of the aspects that enable her to be cast as a feminist icon. And I guess another would be exactly what you were saying, that she's actually completely unapologetic about her own sexuality. Mm-hmm. So she begins her career as a pinup, doesn't she?
That's right. Yeah. So pinups are quite a new thing. A couple of decades old, really. I mean, obviously hugely popular in World War II. So for American, they will, you'll have pinups in your barracks. People will paint nubile young girls on the tails of on bits of their planes and things like that. And that's how she makes a start, isn't it? But also there's another war connection, isn't there? Because she gets into the sort of the pinup business through being photographed when she's working in a munitions factory? Yeah, yes, in Los Angeles.
And she's married very young, I think kind of 3 weeks after her 16th birthday. And her husband is drafted and goes abroad. Both of them are kind of very much involved in the Second World War. The husband is a soldier, she's working in a munitions factory, and that's where she gets kind of talent spotted. And
yes.
And so she's unapologetic about the pinups, but also interestingly, she gets photographed nude. And in due course, this becomes a great scandal, because when she's become a star, the knowledge of these photographs become public. And again, rather than denying it, she makes no apologies for it whatsoever.
Yeah. I mean, I think actually, there's no disgrace in being a pinup girl. So the two big pinups of the late 1930s and 1940s, Rita Hayworth and Betty Grable, I mean, in a way, they're not unrespectable figures. They're enormously popular kind of stars, recognized not just in the United States, but all over the world. And that clearly is Marilyn's ambition. She thinks that she can be, she can be a pinup, she can be a film star, as they are a sex symbol. And that's when she starts doing things like she straightens her hair, she dyes her hair blonde. Now, again, biographers have sort of taken the dyeing of her hair blonde as this sort of Faustian bargain.
Yeah.
This she's lost touch with her authenticity. But of course, there are thousands upon thousands of women who are doing this at precisely this time because they want to become pinups or because they want to, break into Hollywood or whatever. I mean, what distinguishes her actually is not the fact that she's inauthentic or anything like that. Having a new name, having a new sort of hairdo is completely standard. I think it's that she works so hard. She's harder working than most. She's very, very professional, and she's within the sort of boundaries of that world. She is smart, and she, photographers say she's always looking to try and, find the right angle.
Yeah.
She works harder than others, all of those kinds of things.
Well, again and again, when you read about people who either photographed Marilyn or filmed her, they say there seemed to be nothing particularly impressive about her. And often they'll say she's quite chaotic. You think, how on earth has she made it this way? And then they look at the rushes or they look at the stills and they say she is just transcendently wonderful. There's a kind of amazing quote from Eve Arnold, who was the first woman to join, I think, the Magnum Photos agency. So, a woman who really knew what she was talking about. And she said that she never knew anyone who even came close to Marilyn in natural ability to use both photographer and still camera. And clearly it's Marilyn's ability to appear on film that, again, I guess, makes her a kind of archetypal figure, that in a way she's exploiting the reach of this new technology in a way that no one else can quite equal and quite rival.
Well, I mean, that's an interesting one. Can anybody else equal it? I mean, there had been big stars before. I mentioned two of them, Rita Hayworth and Betty Grable. There would be other big stars in the 1950s. I think other people do rival it. And actually, when you look at the sort of, they would do huge surveys of exhibitors, of the people who ran cinemas, to see who were the biggest stars, who were the people who actually got people through the doors. And Marilyn Monroe was never higher than fifth, and she only actually appears in the top 10 in 2 years, 1953 and 1954. So I think she was equaled in a sort of purely cinematic sort of capacity. But I think what makes her different is that she symbolizes more than anybody else two elements of sort of womanhood that people are looking for in the 1940s during World War II, and then in the transition to kind of Eisenhower era affluence. And they are a kind of sexual availability and a kind of voluptuousness and stuff. And the other is a kind of innocent girlishness. And obviously it doesn't, you know, you don't have to be a sort of brain surgeon to be able to locate those to the anxieties that are afflicting people in an era of wartime and dislocation and instability and so on, that men who are separated from their wives, from their families, are kind of craving an idealized kind of girlish but sexually available sort of fantasy figure, don't you think?
Yeah, absolutely. But I do also think that the degree to which he remains to this day an icon, far more than any other female or indeed male actor from the period, is due reflection of her ability to look good on film. And I think that that's a quality that has enabled her image to be reproduced. And it's also why she's a key figure, not just in film, not just in magazines, but also in advertising, isn't she? So as she does now, so back then, she could sell things to a ferocious degree.
I think you're right, Tom.
The most famous photo of her is dabbing Chanel number 5, isn't it, on herself?
Chanel, exactly. The fact that the pinup itself is a kind of consumerist, you know, it's a product, right? I mean, you buy pinups, you get them in magazines also, and so on. She's always kind of implicated in the world, in the sort of booming world of American consumerism. And I do think that it's not just that she's advertising the product, but of course she is also the product, isn't
well,
she?
I mean, she's the... Yeah. So the seediest manifestation of that is that the nude photos for which she got paid $50 or something, they get bought by Hugh Hefner. He buys the negatives for $500. He slaps them all over Playboy and he makes millions from them. So there's a story.
Yeah, as we go towards the break, let's just get her into Hollywood, Tom.
Yeah, so let's not end on that note. Yes, yeah, so she separates from her first husband, divorces him.
Yeah.
She gets picked up by a range of talent agents, directors who recognize her talent. She starts to appear in major films, so Gentlemen Prefer Blondes, which features the song that I impersonated so magnificently at the start of this episode.
Yeah, so that's 1953 is really the year. She's done a few films in the early 50s, but 53 she did Niagara, Gentlemen Prefer Blondes, and How to Marry a Millionaire. And I guess it's the combination of those three, isn't it, that really...
Yeah.
Because that's the first year, 53, in which she appears in this top 10 for the exhibitors, this poll based on, you know, who are the big stars of the day. So she's not as big, actually, as, you know, John Wayne or Gary Cooper. And she's not perhaps as, she doesn't have the prestige, nothing like the prestige of a Katharine Hepburn or somebody, but she would get people through the doors, I think, by the end of 1953 in a way that she wouldn't have done a couple of years earlier.
And then it's the events that happen after that kind of leverage her to become more than just a film star and make her a cultural icon. So when we come back after the break, perhaps we'll look at that. We'll look at Joe DiMaggio, Arthur Miller, and the Kennedys.
Very good. We'll see you after the break. Welcome back to The Rest is History. We're talking about Marilyn Monroe. And Tom, you were saying, so Marilyn Monroe is a film star by 1953, having started out as a pinup. But you were saying that it's her associations that make her more than just a film star. So the first is Joe DiMaggio, who she marries in January 1954. So Joe DiMaggio, I mean, he's a great baseball star, isn't he? And as a cricketer yourself, you'll presumably know all about this this version of rounders that is popular in America.
he star of the New York Yankees, Dominic.
Yeah, I don't really follow baseball myself, Tom.
No, but I mean, he's a hugely significant figure within baseball. I mean, kind of massive, massive star. And his presumption when he falls very, very deeply in love with Marilyn. She loves him clearly. And I think always she seems to be looking for emotional rather than financial support. Would you say that's fair? I mean, although she plays gold diggers in a whole number of films, she clearly wasn't a gold digger that wasn't what she was about. And Joe DiMaggio is a very sober, conservative figure, really. And so perhaps embodied, again, I'm kind of veering into the psychoanalysis. It's almost impossible to avoid when talking about Marilyn, but perhaps she embodied a measure of solidity that she'd always been looking for. But the problem is that it begins to dawn on Joe DiMaggio that actually Marilyn is becoming a star that is putting his own fame slightly in the shadow. So they go on a tour to Japan where Joe DiMaggio is going to be doing some coaching. And she gets completely mobbed when they land in Tokyo. And at the press conference, It's all about her. It's not about DiMaggio. So you can see he's getting slightly cross about that. And then this is the time of the Korean War. And so Marilyn volunteers to go and entertain the troops in Korea, which she does brilliantly because you said she's incredibly hardworking. I also think she's just a very lovable person. People love her and the troops adore her. And she comes back. And she tells her husband, you have no idea what it's like to hear people cheering for you.
That's right. He says,
yes, I do.
Yeah. But he thinks clearly that he's an old-fashioned kind of Italian, slightly conservative Italian-American kind of blue-collar guy, isn't he, Joe DiMaggio? Each of them, I think, thinks of the other as it's too harsh to say a sort of trophy spouse, but there's an element of that. She's the absolute, the stunning Hollywood starlet that is now his wife. From her point of view, he is the sort of strong, silent, as you said, the sort of enormously successful sports star.
And she knew nothing about sport. She knew nothing about, she'd basically never heard of him.
So both of them are slightly challenged, I think, by the other's fame. I mean, the most famous story about the two of them is that he's watching in absolute, in a state of utter fury while she is being photographed in that, or filmed in that enormously famous scene that they used to promote the 7-year itch, when she's standing on the grating in Manhattan and the sort of the wind is blowing up her skirt.
I have visited the very spot, Dominic.
Have you?
The last time I was in New York, I went and saw it. Yeah.
And was it, as gratings go, did it delight you?
It was a great grate.
Very good. Yeah, but he doesn't like this at all, Joe DiMaggio, does he? I mean, there are loads of people watching, and he hates the idea of his wife being a kind of, a fantasy for all these other people, and a willing fantasy, I suppose. That's what he dislikes about it.
And if he's objecting to that, then, I mean, in a way, it's his worst nightmare, because, of course, that image, it's the photo shoot, not really the film. I mean, it's a key part of the film. But in a sense, the fame of that image has been divorced from the 7-year itch. I watched the 7-year itch a couple of nights ago, and it doesn't stand up. It's a pretty terrible film.
But Tom, isn't that true of, just to break off from the chronology, isn't that one of the peculiar things about Marilyn Monroe, that most of her films are barely watched today? That she has an afterlife that the films don't.
Some Like It Hot, I think, is still watched.
Some Like It Hot, I agree with you, is still watched. But do people watch Gentlemen Prefer Blondes? Do they watch Niagara? Do they watch The Misfits? Do they watch Bus Stop? I would say the answer to all those questions is a very, very firm no. And it's a weird thing that everybody recognises Marilyn Monroe, but probably of those people who recognise her, 90% have never seen and will never see one of her films. I mean, she's not appearing in absolutely sort of, the films she's appearing in are not top films, are they? They're not films that win Academy Awards in the 1950s. They're not necessarily box office sort of chart topping films. She has a persona that goes well beyond the appeal of an individual picture, I would say.
But again, I think it's going back to what Eve Arnold said about her ability to use a photograph, to use, the synergy between photograph and her image and her understanding of how to make it work. Because that image is probably, I would say that's the most famous image from a film, would you say?
Yeah.
I mean, I can't think of anything more iconic.
The image of her with her skirt?
Yeah.
It's one of the, I suppose it's one of the most famous. But again, what does that image represent? It's a kind of hedonism, an sexual availability.
It's New York as well, I think.
It's New York, but there's also a kind of innocence to it, but it's all obviously from a very, it's men who like that image, isn't it? I mean, I don't think women sort of line up to have a look at that grating. I think it's men who are titillated by it.
You're saying that I only went to the grate because I was titillated? Not at all, Dominic. It was a tour of Midtown New York, and it was mentioned, so I went to see it.
Tom, frankly, it makes a refreshingly red-blooded change from the tours of Roman walls in car parks, obscure pilgrimage sites, and all these kinds of things. It gladdens my heart to hear that you're doing these kinds of tours as well.
Well, so talking of the marriage of beauty and etiolated intellect, of course,
yes.
So she separates from Joe DiMaggio.
Very much like the dynamic in this podcast, Tom, to be honest.
She separates from Joe DiMaggio.
Yeah.
And she has a bust up with the studios in Hollywood, who have basically been ripping her off. And she makes a point. She goes to New York and she pursues interests that she'd never before had the opportunity to pursue. So she wants to become a better actress. I think she's a brilliant actress, but she's always kind of crippled by a sense of insecurity. And so she takes up method acting. She takes up psychoanalysis. So these are all absolutely kind of archetypal 50s New York intellectual pursuits. And it's there that she really starts to get on well with the great playwright of his day, the playwright Arthur Miller. They end up together. And it generates one of the great headlines, Egghead Marries Hourglass, which is...
Yes.
But it's... her marriage to Arthur Miller, though, and Dominic, you'll know much more about this than me, embroils her in the anxiety on the part of particularly the Republicans about supposed communist infiltration into Hollywood. And one of the reasons that I guess that Marilyn gravitates towards JFK rather than, say, to Richard Nixon is that Nixon had been particularly involved with that, hadn't he?
Well, I'm not sure there's an alternative reality in which maybe there is. I mean, what a fantastic, fantastic fantasy that would be, in which Marilyn Monroe has a relationship with Richard Nixon, one of the great lost couples of the 20th century. Yeah, so Arthur Miller, I mean, his most famous play is Death of a Salesman, 1949, The Crucible, 1953. So he's already written his greatest works. And as you say, he is largely because of The Crucible, he's identified with the sort of anti-McCarthyist. So the McCarthyist movement, the kind of the witch hunts, the Red Scares, the belief that America is being betrayed and sold out by communist subversives. By the time she marries him, actually, McCarthyism has kind of passed its peak. So it's a little bit safer than it would have been 4 or 5 years earlier.
It's still courageous, isn't it, that she stands by him at a time when people's careers are being cancelled or, you know, at least, I mean, she must have had the anxiety that it might have been. I think it reflects very well on her.
I suppose so. I think you're enormously sort of, you're very keen on Marilyn Monroe, I know, Tom, so I don't want to say anything that will dampen your ardour.
Please don't ruin it for me.
I don't think he is under any serious threat in the sort of, what is it, 1956 they get married?
Yeah, but he doesn't have to be under serious threat for both of them to think that he is under threat.
I suppose so. I mean, I think you're slightly exaggerating it, to be honest. I mean, he's a hugely popular and respected figure in kind of New York intellectual circles. The great heat of McCarthyism has largely faded. Okay, but fine. What she is doing, I'll throw a sop to you. She is identifying herself, I suppose, with a particular American subculture in the mid-1950s.
Yeah.
I mean, he is, you know, he's Jewish. He's very much a kind of New York intellectual kind of figure. He moves in circles that are utterly different from those that she knew in Los Angeles in the kind of, certainly in the pinup world, or indeed the film world. So she is sort of, I mean, to some extent, this is part of her sort of crusade of self-improvement, isn't it? Yes. Doing the psychoanalysis, doing the method acting with Lee Strasberg, hanging around with Arthur Miller and his sort of boffin friends.
Reading Dostoevsky and Ulysses.
Exactly. All of this sort of stuff. This is all part of her upward trajectory. People did sneer at it at the time and they laughed at it and they said, oh, this sort of thick, dumb blonde.
But she was never thick. She was incredibly smart.
No.
And I don't think it's just my devotion to Marilyn making me say that. I mean, you can see she's a very, very witty woman. And
well, I mean, she's not incredibly smart, Tom. I mean, she's quite smart.
She's smart. And her understanding of the dynamics of the world that she's in is very, very clear. So why shouldn't she enjoy Dostoevsky?
Well, I think that's fine. I think there's probably a middle ground. So I think, is it John Huston who said of her, Yeah, he thought she was quite smart. The great director, John Huston, he said, on the other hand, he said, she was tremendously pretentious. She had done a lot of shit-ass studying in New York, but she acted as if she never understood why she was funny, and that was precisely what made her so funny.
Yeah, but Dominic, this is for the same reason you don't like John Lennon. Very similar trajectory, going off to New York, being pretentious.
No, I think there's a I wouldn't put her in the same basket as Lennon, Tom. I mean, I wouldn't do that.
Well, that's
anyway. Listen, I mean, by my standards, that is
high praise indeed. Yes,
very high praise. So anyway, she returns to she has a disastrous trip London. To England.
She goes to London to the Prince and the Showgirl with Laurence Olivier.
So it's a Terence Rattigan play, and Olivier absolutely despises her, doesn't he? Let's be honest. I mean, he has no time for it at all.
Yes. He be sexy, dear Marilyn.
He doesn't have any time for method acting, Olivier, as he famously said to Dustin Hoffman, when Dustin Hoffman was doing Marathon Man with him, and explaining how he ran marathons all the time, and he did all this to practice for it and all this, and he got into the character, and Olivier supposedly said to him, "My dear boy, have you never thought of acting?"
I don't think it's Marilyn's method acting that annoys him. I think it's the slight quality of the chaotic that he finds infuriating. Oh, yeah. But again, it's this kind of magic that she has, that when they look at the rushes and they put the film together, her performance is transcendent and much better than Olivier's.
Well, Olivier says that himself.
But she, I think, acts him off the screen.
Well, he says that later on he put on the film for friends, thinking they would all laugh at it and laugh at her. And he said by the time it was over, you know, it was very clear that she had been by far the best person in it. And he admits that himself, to do him credit. So yeah, I don't think there is definitely a degree of kind of hauteur from him when she comes over, this sort of American blonde bombshell. Ha ha ha, she's saying big words that she doesn't understand. But to do him credit, I think he came to recognize his own mistake. Anyway, she goes back to...
Well, no, hold on, Dominic. Hold on. Because also she meets the Queen.
Born in the same year, of course, 1926.
Born in the same year. And supposedly she had a lesbian fling with Brigitte Bardot at the reception for the Queen.
That's absolute balderdash, isn't it? That's one of those stories that's completely made up.
I know, but I just thought I'd put it out there.
Yeah, I knew you'd love a story like that. I mean...
No, not at all. I'm just... But it's all about the intersection of royalty and Hollywood and French sophistication, and the intersection point makes a story like that irresistible. So I think that's kind of interesting demonstration of how when you have the ingredients, people just can't resist mixing them all up and generating a fantastical concoction. I just throw that out there.
Fantastical concoction. So by this point, actually, the funny thing is that by this point, 1956, 1957, I mean, she's probably more famous than she's ever been. And yet you could argue that there were the shining exception of Some Like It Hot, the Billy Wilder film that is yet to come, the best days of her career are already behind her. So it's at this point that she drops out of those lists of the biggest stars, the stars who will basically get bums on seats in American cinemas. And actually, Some Like It Hot is the only film that she has yet to make that anybody ever watches today. I mean, that's pretty much right, isn't it? She's got,
yeah, I think so.
You know, what? She's got about 6 years to live. But actually, those 6 years are pretty unhappy years, one way or another. I mean, she's becoming increasingly dependent on pills and drugs, the lateness, the endless, demanding endless retakes. You know, it's actually a fairly, it's a sort of, you don't have to see it through the lens of her death and to, you know, with this sort of teleology, knowing that the sort of her doom is fast approaching, to see it as actually a pretty standard Hollywood story of somebody who's had this tremendous rise, this peak, and now the decline begins. Or do you think I'm being too harsh, Tom?
No, I don't think so. She makes this film, The Misfits, that's been written by Arthur Miller, and it's a kind of pretentious Western, I guess would be the best way to describe it. And she doesn't really like it. She doesn't like the script, and she doesn't like the because it's clearly it's Miller's portrayal of his wife, and she doesn't like the portrayal. And we should say as well that while in England, she's supposedly seen a diary entry that Miller had written criticizing her, which is conventionally cast as a kind of mortal blow to her relationship. And The Misfits was kind of designed to be the film that would showcase her as a kind of great tragic actress. And it doesn't really work. And it's part of it contributes to the disintegration of her marriage to Miller. And so they separate. And so she's back on her own again. Would you go so far as to say that she doesn't like being alone? I mean, she's nervous of being alone. I think
she's needy. I think most people say that she's quite a needy person, which is not unreasonable. I mean, there are lots of needy people. And I mean, to delve once more into the sort of murky waters of amateur psychology.
Yes. Well, that's what I was worrying that you'd accuse me of doing.
But it's fine when I do it, Tom. I mean,
well, yes, go ahead.
No, but I mean, she's somebody who's had a troubled or a background with a pretty high degree of instability. So it makes sense that she would crave a degree of stability. And you're right. She's not good at being on her own. Her health is pretty awful.
She's popping pills like nobody's business by this point.
Yeah. And she suffers quite badly from endometriosis, for example. She's taking a lot of pills. Again, these things are not, because she dies in 1962, we read everything backwards. So we say, oh, she's popping pills, therefore she's on a downward spiral that will end in disaster. But of course, lots of people are taking a lot of pills. Barbiturates are very common in Hollywood and in New York at the turn of the 1960s. So that doesn't make her tremendously unusual, I would say.
No. But also, you say that, I mean, after Some Like It Hot, her films slightly go off the boil. But her ability to situate herself in the kind of the crosshairs of American life remains unexampled. So she becomes very close to Frank Sinatra, probably the biggest name in music in the world at the time, and the Rat Pack, and of course, rumored affairs with Bobby Kennedy, and
yes,
his mother, the President of the United States, John F. Kennedy.
Okay, so this obviously transforms her historical reputation, doesn't it? Her posthumous reputation. I mean, we see it her entire life now through the lens of those supposed Kennedy relationships. Here's what I think about those. John F. Kennedy was a man who had an enormous number of affairs. Whether he was, you know, people have different sort of theories about why, actually. Is it because he suffers from Addison's disease and his horrendous kind of health complaints and therefore he's trying to blot out the pain? Is it because he has this kind of droit de seigneur?
Yes.
This kind of aristocratic. Yes. Or is it just that he's, you know, an extremely good-looking, kind of slightly oversexed sort of bloke in 1960s America? Marilyn Monroe, I think, without any doubt, had a liaison with him or multiple liaisons. It almost certainly wasn't a love affair. There's no reason to believe that it was. And there's no reason to believe that there's anything especially, actually even that exciting about it. It's only a sort of prurient voyeurism that has elevated this into something.
I don't think it's just voyeurism, though, is it? It's the conspiracy theory. It's the sense that there are deep truths and the fact that she then dies.
Yeah, I know. But I mean, Sarah Churchill is very good about this. She sort of says maybe they were just having an affair because, you know, they quite fancied each other and
of course.
They saw each other a few times and that's an end to it.
Of course.
That's not unheard of in the history of the human race.
Of course. But because she's having an affair with Kennedy and with Sinatra, and Sinatra, you know, and she goes to hang out with Sinatra in places that are clearly funded by the mafia. So Sinatra gives her a dog and she calls it Maff after the mafia. So she's very much aware of all this. So she is an intersection point between the mafia and JFK. And that, I think, is why it's become part of the broader narrative generated by Kennedy's assassination the year after Marilyn's death. And what about Bobby Kennedy?
I've always found that story a tiny bit more implausible, actually. It's actually the more common one that people tell. So people get very excited about the thought that she had an affair with the Attorney General, Robert Kennedy. And in fact, you will often read in this sort of more exploitative biographies that they were this tremendous love affair and they were this sort of couple that were separated by fate and all this kind of thing. I mean, you could hardly think of two more different personalities than Robert Kennedy and Marilyn Monroe. Robert Kennedy was a very controlled, intense, serious kind of man, who was his brother's hatchet man, actually, at this time in his career, as it sort of in JFK's campaign in 1960, and then as his attorney general. Robert Kennedy also had a colossal amount of children within a very short period of time, because he's a very kind of serious Catholic. So he's got about 27 kids. I mean, just a preposterous number of children. I don't know. I think the thing about the affair with Robert Kennedy is there is literally no evidence at all. So all there is gossip that is that's constantly sort of, you know, recirculated in all the different biographies. But there's no kind of documentary evidence that they had this relationship. It's just pure supposition.
But the same is true of Roswell, of course.
Well, yeah. Yes, it's about the same level as Roswell, I think it's fair to say, Tom. I think that's a very good comparison.
Yeah. Yeah, and so that's this is the background. Kennedy's, Sinatra, that is providing the context for the years, the months, the days that leads up to her death.
Right. I mean, the big thing that happens in the run-up to her death that everybody will remember is she sings happy birthday to Kennedy at Madison Square Garden. His birthday, he has this sort of premature birthday celebration, and I think it's the 19th of May, 1962. And she is squeezed into this incredibly sort of sexy figure-hugging dress. And she sings in a very sort of breathy kind of way.
Breathy,
exactly. It was a breathy way. I mean, it's just a very, this sort of, you know, overtly sexualized way, happy birthday, Mr. President. And for everybody in the know, I mean, they think it's quite close to the bone. It's quite on the nose. It's quite funny that she's almost publicly flaunting the fact they've had a relationship. But again, had she not died several months later, and had he then not died and had a second term as president and been embroiled in Vietnam, would this be this sort of doomed moment? I mean, obviously it wouldn't be.
But it did, and so it is. I mean,
that's... Yes, fair enough.
That's the whole point. I mean, point entirely taken, but she does die, and she kind of dies, she dies at the age of 36, the same age that Byron died. And it's that enables her to, you know, she doesn't grow old.
But what don't you think though? What you think of the death colours the entire story?
Of course, absolutely. You back project it, absolutely, completely.
Yeah, you back project the whole thing. Or if you think that she committed suicide because she's so miserable and unhappy,
of course,
she's been a victim all her life.
Yeah, or she's being murdered by Bobby Kennedy or JFK or the mafia or whoever. I mean, of course, absolutely.
I mean, but listeners will not be surprised that I do not think she was murdered by the mafia.
Do you think it was Bobby Kennedy then?
I don't think she's murdered by the Kennedys. Donald Spoto, one of her biographers, has a complicated theory about that. Basically, is that it boils down to it being an accident. Sarah Churchwell, I think, thinks it was probably an accident. That seems as likely as anything to me. I mean, the truth is, again, we cannot know. So anybody who tells you they know is wrong, is just wrong, because we cannot know. But I think the most likely thing is that she's taking an awful lot of pills of various kinds, and she probably takes an accidental overdose. I mean, again, it's hardly uncommon among Hollywood film stars, rock stars, and so on of the 1960s and 1970s, is it? I mean,
but so people compare her to Elvis or to Jim Morrison or whatever, you know, famous people who die young. But I think that she's much better thought of as part of that nexus of weird conspiracy. So I mentioned Roswell. I think it's not. I think she has become part of that kind of industry of conspiracy theories. But because she, you know, she it's not just that she was intimate with key. I mean, you know, Arthur Miller, Joe DiMaggio, the Kennedys, Frank Sinatra. I mean, these are titanic figures in the culture of mid-century America. But also that she is so beautiful, and she dies young. And I think I'm right that the first of the screen prints that Warhol does is of Marilyn. So she blazes the path for all the other Chairman Mao's and Elizabeth II and all the other ones that he'll go on to do. Sarah Churchwell is brilliant on this, on how the moment she dies, and maybe even before she's died, the myth is cannibalizing her, the real Marilyn. And so it has always done. And I think that the fact that someone can be cannibalized to the degree that she has been tells us a lot about the evolution of popular culture and media over the decades that have followed her death. Don't you think?
I think that's true. I think the timing is really important. So she dies in 1962, in the summer of 1962. Kennedy dies in the autumn of 1963. So they're quite compressed. Robert Kennedy dies in 1968, the same year as Martin Luther King. Both Marilyn Monroe and John F. Kennedy died before the 60s took, you know, what in sort of narrative terms are their sort of dark downward turn. So they both die before the war in Vietnam really comes to dominate the headlines. They die before the civil rights movement, before the sort of the marches and the martyrdom give way to kind of to the riots in 1966, 67, 68. Yeah, and assassinations, until violence comes to dominate the headlines rather than, let's say, justice, if you like. So I think...
Do you think that that gets back projected, the sense that there is a kind of violence within American public life that devours its own?
I mean, I think that to some degree, I suppose you could say that violence was always there, simmering below the surface. But I think you're right that these now in the sort of standard pop cultural narrative become kind of great harbingers of doom, don't they? The death of Marilyn Monroe and the death of John F. Kennedy. So if Marilyn had lived, if it was an accident and the accident had not happened, what would her life have looked like in the later 1960s and 1970s? She would presumably have done other films, but not probably very successful films. She would have been yesterday's woman. She'd have been left behind by, I don't know, Faye Dunaway or younger kind of stars who were very different kind of image of sexuality.
Well, I think you look at Elizabeth Taylor, don't you think?
Yeah, exactly, Elizabeth Taylor.
So what happens to Elizabeth Taylor would have been her Marilyn's parabola, I guess.
Yeah. I mean, without being, this may annoy some listeners who are very attached to Marilyn Monroe, but you can imagine a future in which she's walking around in 1972 and she's kind of blousy. There's a lot of booze. She hasn't made a film in 5 years. Directors say she's impossible to work with. You know, she's thrown off a flight. the story kind of writes itself.
She's got off with Richard Nixon at last.
Yes, the couple that was meant to be. I mean, I think because she's cut down when she is in 1962, she becomes the symbol of a kind of lost innocence, I suppose, doesn't she? Because, of course, this is the point up to the 1960s, sexuality and sort of sex is framed very much in terms of kind of increasing availability and visibility and so on. And this sort of, there's no sense or very much less of a sense of it being politically conflicted as it becomes later in the 1960s and then the 1970s. So you talked earlier about her as a sort of feminist figure, but really that sort of 60s feminism has yet to get underway by the time of her death. And it's interesting to think about how she would be perceived. You know, how would she have adapted to that world? Would she have continued to kind of improve herself, as it were, and to sort of ride the wave? Or would she have been left behind? Would she have been a relic of a sort of slightly discredited, shop-soiled kind of 50s
world?
Well,
I suppose the brutal truth is that people probably wouldn't care what she thought, actually. Do people care what Elizabeth Taylor thought? Probably not.
The weird thing is that she wouldn't be the icon that she is now, right? I mean, if the blousiness and the being kicked off Concorde had happened in 1976, you know, Gap used her image in the 1990s. Would they have used it in the 1990s? No, of course they wouldn't, because they don't use Elizabeth Taylor now.
No, I agree. But and so that's why she was so, you know, why the Candle in the Wind could so readily be adapted by Elton John to The Death of Diana as well.
I mean, I think in some ways, the funny thing about Marilyn Monroe is that she's become so confused with
Diana.
With the Kennedy story, hasn't she?
Oh,
and with Diana as well.
Yeah.
Do you know, I mean, she's, well, I mean, that's the interesting thing about Marilyn Monroe, that we could talk for sort of 3 hours and there are lots of different kind of angles into the story. But actually the funny thing is, what is so often missing, what we struggle to get a sense of, is actually the woman herself, isn't it? Because a lot of what we've talked about in this podcast has been about iconography and about symbolism. But the actual, the reality of the woman is really hard to get at, I think.
I called her lovable. Every biography of her I've read, whenever she's allowed to speak in her own voice, she comes across as very smart, very funny, very likable. I mean, clearly quite difficult. I mean, she was a Hollywood diva, but I think the most kind of personally attractive of all Hollywood stars, all the big Hollywood stars.
You think so?
I do. Yeah, I do.
You'd rather go for dinner with Marilyn Monroe than with Grace Kelly, Tom?
I think I probably would, yeah.
Okay, well, on that, you and I would differ.
So I suppose, Dominic, I mean, essentially, you know, if we want to sum up what this episode's been about, in a very real sense, she was like a candle in the wind. Is that what you'd say?
Oh, Tom, that's painful. That's painful. No, I think she's a fascinating, she's an example of the challenges of biography on the one hand, and trying to make sense to fit into a historical narrative, the life of a complicated individual. But she's also a brilliant way to talk about 50s and 60s America. And actually, we will be coming back almost exactly a year from now. So that's a long time for listeners to wait. But we will be finally returning to the subject of the Kennedy assassination, won't we, in 2023 for the anniversary. And I'm really looking forward to that because we can go into it in depth and talk about all the conspiracy theories. All of you who listen, who espouse one particular theory or other, you'll all find something to offend you as we dismiss all the theories.
As we reveal
and
the
we
truth.
And we reveal the real truth. Exactly.
Frank Sinatra killing JFK because he'd murdered Marilyn. The truth will out. Well, the truth is out there and we will reveal it. Thanks very much for listening. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.